Tonight, cloudy and 38. Thursday, cloudy and 53. Here are the numbers right now. Sunshine with a blue sky. I see a few scattered clouds out there. 45 degrees for Racine. 44 for Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. A little breeze from the south at 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
I've had the great pleasure on two previous occasions of speaking with best-selling author Andrew Carroll. We have talked about his book, War Letters, and about another book called Operation Homecoming. His most recent book coincides with the 100th anniversary of America's entrance into the First World War, the so-called Great War. And Andrew Carroll's contribution to our reflection on this conflict and our part in it is a marvelous new book called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. This book is intended to be a book that explores what was the personal experience of many who experienced this conflict from the front lines. And it makes use of extensive letters, including many by General John Pershing himself, never seen before. The book is published by Penguin Press. And Andrew Carroll, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's so good to talk to you again.
I'm really happy that we have this opportunity. I should also remind our listeners, for those who were able to see the marvelous American Experience documentary called The Great War, that you were one of the people who were involved in that. You were one of the experts whom we hear from in that marvelous film. Can you say a quick word about the way in which this particular conflict, the First World War, is somehow not as remembered as it really should be? I mean, perhaps more so in this anniversary year, but otherwise how somehow we have managed to forget this conflict, how important it was, and especially how terrible it was.
It really was eclipsed by World War II in particular, and one of the things that really drew me into it, because I frankly kind of counted myself among those who wasn't that fascinated in it. And then I started reading the letters of the young men and women, including those who served as war nurses or ambulance drivers, who were there as early as 1914, 1915, and then of course America officially got involved in 1917. But it was really coming across Pershing's story that got me so interested in the topic, because he'd always seemed like this statuesque figure and really forgotten in many ways, overshadowed by all the World War II generals like Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur, many of whom served under him. Eisenhower never went over to Europe, but he was one of his mentees after the war. But Pershing is actually the highest-ranking general in American history, and he's the only general to essentially earn a sixth star in his lifetime. But what really drew me to his story was the loss of his family. When the war was going on, but a year before the Americans got involved, his wife and his three daughters were all killed in a house fire, and only his young boy Warren was pulled out alive. And it really, when I learned that, it just kind of humanized him. And I wanted to learn more about the war, and it just kind of made me realize how little I had appreciated what these troops had done, their sacrifices. And it was interesting because we did a panel with the Great War for the premiere, and it's being rebroadcast on PBS throughout the spring and the summer. And they really did a phenomenal job with it. And one of the panelists made the point that you could almost argue that World War I is more significant than World War II, not just because of the relation between the two conflicts, but the map that was left of World War I is very much influencing our day in the here and now, that Iraq and Syria and all these places were carved up in World War I, and other issues that we're grappling with in Europe and so forth are really in some ways echoes of that conflict. And so what I wanted to do with the My Fellow Soldiers book is to really make it appealing to the general reader, the person who thinks that they're really not going to be that interested in this topic, as I wasn't, but really kind of show them what a compelling story it is and just how many young Americans sacrificed their lives and fought and bled and waged war for this nation.
I should have asked you this question before we went on the air. I wonder if it would be okay if we explained to the listeners how your foreword begins, or would you rather leave that as a surprise when they read the book?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would rather leave it as a surprise, but I will say this, and this will give a bit of a hint, that this book is really part of a much larger project that goes back to when we first spoke about war letters, almost more than 15 years ago. And then it's ongoing to preserve American war correspondences. And so I started this project. It began all volunteer, and it's nationwide. And it's to encourage Americans to seek out and to preserve letters from the revolution all the way up to emails from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the easiest way for people to learn about this larger campaign, which I'm very passionate about, is just go to our website, warletters.us. So we focus on war letters, and we're American, so it's warletters.us. And it'll give people a better idea of what we're looking for. And I'm barnstorming the country over the next couple months, speaking at American Legion posts, as I am in Milwaukee. People can see my schedule on there. But going to all sorts of venues to really encourage people, look in your attics, your basements, your closets. You might have something that's really extraordinary. And veterans are very modest about what they've written, so I'm trying to encourage them, share what you have. And it's just incredible what people are showing to us. And so the book was sort of inspired by letters that had not been seen before and things that people have shared with me, and that really becomes, I think, the heart and soul of the book.
It really is. Explain, in a sense, what this book is not.
I love that question. It is not a history textbook about World War I. This is a very personal look through, the letters and the journals of those who served, not my personal perspective, but it's a very intimate look at what the war was like. And I really found these extraordinary characters like Victor Chapman, who is the first, one of the great first combat pilots, and Eugene Bullard, the first African-American combat pilot, and then a young Patton, a young Truman, a young MacArthur, what they all went through. And so I really, again, I didn't want this to seem like an academic study. This is almost, I wanted it to read almost like a novel where you follow these characters, but every word is true. Every word comes from what they expressed or wrote or put in a journal. And so it really is, I think, kind of an eyewitness perspective of what it was like to go through that war, in which for the first time we see machine guns and gas and tanks and submarines. So it really was a revolutionary time.
We are speaking with Andrew Carroll about his book, My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. One of the things you tell us is that in many of the letters and journals that you explored, particularly in those of someone by the name of Alan Seeger, you say one topic dominated almost everything else: the trenches. Life in the trenches was an immediate and overwhelming assault on the senses. Tell our listeners, because this is such a central part of how war was fought in this particular conflict, what life in the trenches literally was like for the soldiers unfortunate enough to experience it firsthand.
Well, I don't want to get too graphic, and I'm sure you don't want me to either, so a lot of that's in the book, but definitely, yes. I mean, let me see how I can do this in a discreet way. The smells that you encountered, because there were corpses in no man's land that during the summer months were just left there and were just horrifying, to men relieving themselves in the trenches because there was nowhere else to go, to of course the violence of you could get hit by machine gun fire or a shell lobbing over, and sometimes even by your own shells because the artillery on your side aimed too short. So it was kind of this never-ending stress and tension. And there were even one thing I didn't know about, there were bomb makers who tunneled under the trenches. The enemy would tunnel under you and pack it with explosives, and you would, you know, suddenly see this, you know, explosion coming up from underneath. And so I described that from a guy who witnessed something. He wasn't underneath it. I'm sorry, he wasn't over it himself, but he was some distance away for another of his trenches that was blown up. And it was just this, you know, never-ending terror. And that's one of the things I really wanted to convey to the reader, of just how horrifying this experience was, and really to give us all a better sense of what they went through.
One of the other themes that we sense from some letters is the evolution of attitude in terms of what this conflict was about and what it was like to for a given soldier to fight in it. I think of one particular soldier by the last name of he was nicknamed Champy.
Yep.
And you tell us at one point, as the realities of a soldier's life sank in, Champy's letters became more and more laced with ambivalence and regret. How common was this? How often do we see this in the letters of soldiers who fought in World War One? This, in a sense, eroding morale as the war dragged on.
Well, it definitely ebbed and flowed. And what's interesting about Champy, and I'm glad you brought him up because he's a really fascinating character. He was born in France, moved to America, fell in love with the country, became an American citizen, and then when the war started, he went back to France to fight with his, you know, his original country. And he kind of thought that his friends and family would think less of him if he didn't volunteer. And quite the opposite. They thought he was foolish because he was very well educated and he wanted to be just, you know, the average infantryman. He didn't want to be an officer. And life was just miserable for them. And he was sort of shocked that people actually were like, why would you ever go and do this? And so here he was risking his life. And I think I'll let the reader find out what happens to him. But it was a really intriguing story. And he's often called the first American, although, again, he was French-born, to be killed in the war. And that's not quite correct. I actually found an American who was killed earlier. And in Chicago, where his childhood home was, we're going to put up a plaque in his honor. But Champy wrote these very compelling letters about his experiences. And I think what he expressed in Seeger and other troops was a kind of fatality. And Seeger, of course, wrote the famous poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. And, you know, it was a sense of, you know, you just, if you're going to get killed, it's going to happen. And that was something that was very pervasive in the letters, that just the sense of uncontrollableness, that there was no way of knowing when your number was going to come up, but there was nothing you could do about it. And it's kind of the only way to deal with the threat of death, which is almost kind of just sort of, you know, relinquishing that notion that you have any sort of control. So that's what, to me, really came through the letters from so many different troops, from so many different backgrounds.
It's interesting. A single soldier writing about their own experience is, of course, in a sense, writing about a very narrow slice of what was, for instance, going on. I mean, they know what's going on in the trench in which they are trapped, or the particular group of soldiers with which they are stationed. So in one respect, we are not given the whole picture, and yet cumulatively, these letters provide us with an extraordinarily rich and broad portrait of this conflict and of what it was like to fight it.
Well, I think you've really touched on the key thing I wanted to get across, is that there's almost a kaleidoscope effect, that when you see all these different perspectives, it gives you, as you said, a much richer view of what all these people were experiencing, whether it's in the general's headquarters. And again, I have, you know, the original journals and letters that they wrote, where they're telling about the conversations they're having and the battles that they're fighting, even amongst themselves, about whether American troops are going to be used in this place or that place and when and how and so forth, down to the trench perspective, or literally the pilot's perspective. We have these beautiful letters by American pilots describing being up in the air, and how Quentin Roosevelt, who was Theodore Roosevelt's son, had a very, I thought, sort of amusing line, because it was freezing up there. These were open cockpits. These were the original warplanes. And he said, I don't know how the angels stand it. It's just so cold up here, and it's changed my view on religion. And there's actually a very poignant exchange between General Pershing and Theodore Roosevelt when Quentin is shot down, because Pershing had experienced, you know, great family loss, as TR did. And, you know, and I don't want to give the impression that everything in the book is depressing and miserable. There's a beautiful love story in the book. And in fact, I came across essentially the last letter that Pershing wrote to the woman he eventually married, and it's one of the most beautiful love letters I've ever read in my life, and I think really shows a different side of him too. So it really gives you all these different facets of the human experience in times of war, and I think that they're really universal, that you know, even though the trench warfare was very unique to World War One, just you know, what you go through, whether it's in the jungles of Vietnam or in, you know, villages in Iraq when the Marines are fighting door-to-door in Fallujah, that experience of being under fire, of risking your life, really is timeless.
Absolutely. Well, and as somebody said in one of their own letters, death could come from any direction. And
literally.
And yes, and that is a reality that most of us can't begin to imagine.
Yeah, and I really wish that, you know, we had greater admiration for this generation of soldiers because, you know, there was no Pearl Harbor-like attack that caused America to get involved in the war. So there wasn't that sense of, that, you know, of retribution or revenge. They really kind of went in on principle. They felt that what the Germans were doing to the Belgians and the French and so forth really had to be stopped. And so to me, in that sense, there's a great nobility in the World War One generation. And I think, again, they've been sort of eclipsed. There's no national memorial on here in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, on the Mall for World War One. And there's a beautiful memorial in Kansas City and very much, you know, the national memorial. But, again, on the National Mall with all these other incredible memorials, there's nothing for World War One. And that, to me, I think is an indication of how this generation has been overlooked and deserves more attention.
Well, your marvelous book is certainly part of that effort. The book, again, is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War, published by Penguin Press, the author, Andrew Carroll. Andrew Carroll, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and more importantly, thank you for writing this very important book.
Thank you. And again, I just want to encourage your listeners, warletters.us, that's what we're really passionate about. Obviously, we want to, you know, I love the book, but the overall project is what's most meaningful. So thank you so much for helping us spread the word.
My guest for part two of today's morning show, Suzanne Gordon, is an award-winning journalist and author who has written and lectured extensively about healthcare with 18 previous books to her credit. She's focused her attention over the last several years on veterans' healthcare, and her most recent book is titled The Battle for Veterans' Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care, which comes from Cornell Publishing. In the book, she defends our veterans' healthcare system against the attacks of those who would seek to dismantle it.
Well, the VA, I mean, there's been just literally thousands of studies, Greg, that that demonstrate that the VA delivers care that's equal to or superior to that in the private sector. And obviously, it's inexcusable if any veteran or any patient is hurt anywhere. You know, even if you, they're basically the whole thing about the VA, the Veterans Health Administration, and, you know, we really have to make a distinction between the Veterans Health Administration and the Veterans Benefit Administration. And we really have to look at where the problems arise. I mean, what's the root cause analysis if there are wait times in the VA? The root cause is because Congress has imposed very strict, cumbersome, and I believe irrational eligibility requirements on which veterans can get health care, and that causes all kinds of delays at the Veterans Benefit Administration, which is chronically understaffed and underfunded, and veterans have to assemble these complex case files to show that they have a service-connected disability. Often the problem actually begins in the Department of Defense because military service members are often discouraged from going to the doctor or the medic when they have a problem, particularly if it's an emotional problem. And so they don't even have a record of a problem so that they can show that they have a service-connected disability that will then allow them to get benefits from the VHA.
So when we think about these kind of impediments being in place, in some respects, it's a wonder that the situation isn't even worse, and it's a wonder that that veterans are receiving as fine of care as they are.
Well, I think we really just have to get rid of the idea that the VA is broken. You know, the VA has some problems. It's the largest healthcare system in the country. It's the only integrated healthcare system in the country. It's one of the largest in the world. I mean, you know, the Cleveland Clinic, which is often touted as being a model for what the VA should be, between 2010 and 2013 was under investigation by Medicare and Medicaid services and was almost suspended from the program, which would have meant essentially that the hospital would have had to close down, you know, because of patient safety issues. One of the main whistleblowers in the Cleveland Clinic scandal was a veteran. When the media reports on the Cleveland Clinic today, it doesn't say the scandal-ridden Cleveland Clinic, yet every media report that you see about the VA is the scandal-ridden agency. It is not a broken agency. It delivers some of the best health care in the country.
In fact, you say that in terms of being an integrated care model, that it is, in some respects, a paragon that more of our healthcare system should be emulating. What do
Absolutely.
You mean by that?
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, Greg, but when I go to the doctor, you know, I go to the doctor, right? And if he or she wants me to go to a mental health professional, he or she writes a referral, and I have to find that person and drive across town or across the Bay Bridge. I live in San Francisco. If I need a pharmacist or a nutritionist or a social worker, I have to go find them. If I need to have my tinnitus, which I have addressed, I need to find that person. The VA, if you're a veteran and you go through the four screenings that you get when you come to a primary care appointment and you have a mental health problem, your primary care doctor walks you down the hall to the mental health professional and introduces you to them in what they call a warm handoff, or to the pharmacist or nutritionist. And it's like one-stop shopping, and you're much more likely to go to that appointment and start treatment if you have that kind of introduction than if you have to decide whether, you know, gee, I don't really want to lose weight, you know. So that's what we mean by integration. And plus, obviously, a veteran in Boston can move to Peoria and his records or her records will follow and they will get care.
You also mentioned in your booklet that the VA, VHA, they are dealing with, in a sense, a clientele that is, first of all, older, statistically speaking, and also in many cases dealing with a host of very, very serious issues. So that should not be underestimated in terms of understanding and maybe coming to a more nuanced appreciation of the kind of health care that our veterans receive.
Yeah, now, you know, a lot of veterans are being sent through this very bad choice program to Mennett clinics, get the CVS. I mean, this is just a disaster because these veterans have really, as you say, and as I say, complex problems, as I write in my book. I mean, the average person over 65 has three problems that they come to with the doctor. The average veteran, Vietnam veteran, has 9 to 12. I mean, they have PTSD. They have Agent Orange-related prostate cancer. Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have PTSD and traumatic brain injury and burn pit exposures and goodness knows what else. These are really complex patients. And these are almost the only kind of patients the VA sees, because you can't get into the VA if you're healthy and wealthy.
Right. You spell out in your booklet how there are actually some rather stringent eligibility requirements in terms of who is eligible for this kind of care. You also
right.
tell us that an overwhelming majority of veterans do not want the VA or the VHA to be privatized. They want the current system to remain in place but be strengthened.
Absolutely, Greg. The VFW, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, just released yet another survey that was done by a veteran service organization showing that 92%, and this was like 2 weeks ago, 92% of respondents, and many, they had a very good response rate, said they wanted the VA to be strengthened and improved and adamantly opposed any efforts or anything that could dismantle it. And we have to understand really clearly that what the Trump administration, maybe with the best of intentions, is trying to do is essentially begin the process of privatization of the VA by sending more and more veterans to private sector physicians who are simply not ready to handle their problems, even though they have the best of intentions, And it's going to be a very bad problem because the money will follow the veterans into the private sector, out of the VA. They'll have layoffs of doctors, closures of facilities. And what will happen is it won't be a sell-off, you know, but it will be a gradual withering on the vine of the VA. And I think we can't let that happen.
You spell out the fact that the VHA, in your words, has long been anathema to conservatives. I mean, to those conservatives who want to streamline the government, cut it back, this kind of move, of course, makes tremendous sense. I mean, it folds right into their central philosophy. But we have to couple with that the fact that this sort of shift would be a huge boon to, for instance, private sector hospitals. What other entities out there in the healthcare world are, in a sense, hoping that this move to privatization occurs?
Well, hospitals, healthcare systems, pharmaceutical companies, medical equipment companies, the whole vast array of what we now call the medical industrial complex. I mean, there's a, you know, $75 billion or $65 billion, depending on the year budget. It's a huge pot of gold, and the private sector wants it, even though, as the RAND Corporation has shown over and over again, it is simply not ready to serve. Doctors would benefit from this, although I don't think they quite understand the complexity of the patients that they would be seeing. And, you know, the other thing that is really, really important for people to understand is that I think the public at large would really be disadvantaged by this, because suddenly I would be in competition with a veteran for the scarce resources of my primary care doctor, because we don't have enough primary care doctors and mental health specialists to care for the private sector patient population. And then you start adding 9 million veterans, it's going to be a real mess. And it's not going to help sending people to the private sector when there is no private sector facility or specialist or primary care doctor or mental health professional to see them, because, you know, in rural areas where there are a lot of wait time problems in the VA, there are wait time problems in going to your private doctor, and there are no specialists. 55% of American counties have no social worker, psychiatrist, or psychologist at all.
You do acknowledge that there are problems within the healthcare system delivering healthcare to our veterans. In just the minute or so that remain, what would be a couple of the areas in which you would like to see such concerns addressed, and how would they be addressed?
Right. I think we need to end the top-down, heavy-handed management at the VA. We have to stop bashing VA employees and try to figure out where the problems are. We have to start strengthening the VA by allowing the VA to offer market rate salaries to physicians and nurses and health care professionals. They're not allowed to do that now. The VA has to be allowed to advertise, if you will, and hire more public relations people to help the public understand the incredible model of care that it has developed. I see the VA as a model of care for all Americans. It's a government program that works. That's why the right wing doesn't like it, because they don't like government programs that work. And it works, and it can be made to work even better if we fulfill our promise to veterans and to each other.
Author Suzanne Gordon has a website, suzannegordon.com, where more information can be found. She encourages anyone who shares her perspective to contact their elected representatives and also any local veterans groups to find out what they are doing on the important issue of the health care we give to our veterans. Her book, once again, is called The Battle for Veterans Health Care: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. The book is published by Cornell Publishing. Finishing out our morning show on a somewhat lighter note is my conversation with Ira Burko, who is responsible for a beautiful coffee table book that's also loaded with information about Wrigley Field, one of the most iconic stadiums in all of professional sports. The book is titled Wrigley Field, An Oral and Narrative History of the Home of the Chicago Cubs. I really love this book, and not just because I happen to be a Chicago Cubs fan, but because it's so lovingly crafted. And I especially appreciate the way in which you're not especially shy about weaving in your own personal connection to Chicago, to the game of baseball, and to the Cubs.
Yeah.
Can you just say a word about how personal an experience it was to craft this book, and if it was tricky to decide how much of yourself to sort of imprint in its pages?
Well, to answer the last question first, you do it by feel, and you don't want to have too many eyes, in a book. It turns people off. But the fact is that I was born and raised in Chicago, and I spent a good part of my boyhood sneaking into Wrigley Field with my friends from the west side of Chicago. And later I moved to the north side about 3-4 miles from Wrigley Field. But my friends, when I was a boy, 10, 11, 12 years old, we would sneak into Wrigley Field as well as Comiskey Park. But Wrigley Field was always special because it always seemed so beautiful and, oh, so chummy to be around, as opposed to, say, Comiskey Park, which seemed like almost cavernous. And but here you know, Wrigley Field with that great green grass field, which Comiskey Park also had, but Wrigley Field also had the vines on the outfield walls and the red brick retaining wall, which separated the field from the box seats. And the symmetrical, the bleachers rising up to that great hand-worked scoreboard. And we would sneak into the ball game, and then we would sneak down to the box seats, and we'd be sitting, for a while along the third base boxes, and then the ushers would come throw us out. Then we'd move over to the first base boxes, get thrown out there, and just move around someplace else. Hardly before I even knew it, I became a credentialed sports writer, the real thing, and covering games at Wrigley Field. And I remember the first time I did it, it was about 27, 28, and I was behind the batting cage in Wrigley Field, and I kept thinking, any moment now, an usher is going to come and grab me by the collar and throw me out.
You felt like an imposter once again.
I felt like a fraud, and exactly. And but it didn't happen. And I spent a certain amount of time, and whenever I could, I had family and parents who are now gone. But at one point, family and friends, and living there. And so I would always make an effort to when I was writing for the Times and other. I wrote also for a Newspaper Enterprise Association based in New York, who's a national feature syndicate. And I would always make an effort to get to Chicago and write about some Chicago sports. And but always it was pleasurable always to go to Wrigley Field, except for the press box was quite upstairs in the upper decks, and there were no elevators. So you had a climb, up there. But once you got there and looked out, it was, and you could look out on the ballpark and beyond, and see Lakeshore Drive and see the Lake Michigan and the boats on Lake Michigan, and it almost didn't matter if the Cubs were winning or losing or not. And of course, in the press box, there was the axiom: no cheering in the press box. And so even though my heart was with the Cubs. You still had to be an objective reporter, and
or try.
I tried.
One thing I learned in your book was that the same man designed both Wrigley Field and Comiskey Park, a guy by the name of Zachary Taylor Davis. Tell us what you think he did right in designing Wrigley Field.
Well, somehow he made the stands closer to the field, for one thing. And, but as time went on, the ballpark changed, its integrity a number of times. I think that the White Sox and Comiskey Park wanted it to be, the ballpark to kill, to kill all ballparks. And it was going to be like almost like a castle. But Chicago, again, the Wrigley Field,
was just going to be a ballpark rather than a stadium. And I think those terms make a difference in perception of the park. And so it was always more fun to go to a ball game in Wrigley Field than it was to Comiskey Park. And they eventually tore down Comiskey Park and then built the U.S. Cellular Field across the street, across 35th Street in Chicago, from where the Comiskey Park was. Old Comiskey Park is now a parking lot.
Right. I lived in Chicago in the mid-1980s when I was an apprentice at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I lived just a few blocks from Wrigley Field. And,
this is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
As a lot of stadiums are, you probably wouldn't have the same sense of its size. But I wonder if you felt like that as well. I mean, as a youngster, and of course back then it wasn't small as ballparks went, but there is a grandeur to it because of the fact that it's right in the middle of that neighborhood.
Right. Well, growing up, and I hadn't gone to other ballparks, maybe in my mind I hardly even compared it to Comiskey Park. There was just a feel, a sense of those places, and. The neighborhood makes a difference, and you get off the elevated train and you walk through the neighborhood stores to get to the ballpark and the apartment buildings and a little distance away the bungalows, the little homes, somehow there's a sense of being home. And it was one of the smallest. It still is, as far as capacity, seating capacity is concerned, is 41,000 now. But they have to make more money. They've constructed more luxury suites, and that also with the Ricketts family who bought the ballpark from the Tribune a few years ago, Chicago Tribune Company. They have built. They're going to put in a jumbotron. And other kinds of signage, and I don't know how that's going to change the integrity of this architectural gem, really. I was opposed to putting in lights. I thought that would take away some of the charm of this ballpark. But they put in the lights in a very classy way, I was imagining lights with stanchions like a lot of the old ballparks, like some of these modern parks too, but. They put sort of low-lying lights around the roof and rooftop, and they're almost elegant, and so it blends in to the rest of the atmosphere of the ballpark. So I was heartened by this.
Right. The years I lived in Chicago were the years that was being hotly debated, and one of the things I remembered was you could walk into a shop or a restaurant in the neighborhood. And complete strangers would easily strike up a conversation about that matter of lights or no lights. And, of course, you saw those no light signs all over the place. And ultimately, of course, the other side won the day. Your book mentions the fact that that among the things done to do this in sort of a classy, respectful, considerate way is the fact that there's a sharp curb on how many night games under the lights actually can be played at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, one of the protests came from a lot of the people living in the neighborhood, and they didn't want all that congestion at night and horns blowing and noise from the ballpark and then the lights and they just thought it would create a mess, and I'm not quite sure that has come to pass. But it's a fait accompli, and they're playing a minimum of night games. The Chicago City Council made a ordered the Cubs, when they made an agreement to have nights, that they could play only a minimum of night games. But it seems that that every year there's one or two more night games than were previously scheduled. So, so the Cubs are starting to move in on the way other teams play.
One of the things that's striking about the story you tell about the Chicago Cubs, and that's really mostly what this book is about, is the history of this venerable organization.
Yeah.
Is
and the
how
players, of course.
Yes,
and
of course.
Players, yeah.
Is that there are these there are long stretches in which the Cubs seem to be an organization very strongly rooted to the past and to tradition. And then there'll be these other instances in which the Cubs prove to be fairly innovative in things that they try to do, with things like broadcasting games over the radio or telecasting games. I believe your book says at one point that the Cubs were among the first major league teams to do that.
Yeah, and Ladies' Day. They innovated Ladies' Day, and then women were once a week. Women were maybe on a weekday they were allowed in free, because mostly the ball games were men were attended the games, and so William Wrigley, the owner of the Cubs at that time, and Bill Veeck, William Veeck Sr., Bill Veeck Jr.'s father. They decided that hey, we have 50% of the population out there. Let's try to draw them in, and so women started going to games free on Wednesday. But if they wanted to come to games alone or with their spouse or with their boyfriend on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, they would have to pay. And but Wednesday they get in free. And so more and more women started coming to games beyond Ladies' Day, and that was an innovation, and it was picked up around the country. And, of course, you know, Ivy on the Walls, which hasn't been copied. Maybe there's another team that has done that. I don't remember. But, you know, so that there were innovations. And there were people who thought that if you have the games on radio – then people would not come to the games. They'd just sit and listen on radio. And the same thing that happened with television. The feeling was, well, you can't televise games. Well, of course, we know now that even though you broadcast games on radio and broadcast them on television, people still come to the ballpark for the experience of being in a live event. And and the Cubs were in the forefront of this.
Absolutely. This book is loaded with amazing photographs, and actually one of my favorites is a shot taken up in the stands, I think in 1931 or 32, of a ladies' day, and you see these unlikely faces staring into the camera from the stands of Wrigley Field. And
with unlikely hats.
Absolutely, it's a great moment in the book. Among one of the things, of course, that's great about this book is that we get to know something about some of the great legends of the game who have played for the Chicago Cubs. But I have to say that one of my favorite moments involving a specific player is when you talk about someone who was a peer, a rival of yours, as you grew up in Chicago playing baseball, a guy by the name of Jim Woods. Nobody now scarcely knows the name because his career in the major leagues was very, very brief indeed.
Right.
But the fact that somebody you knew and had played against had cracked his way into the major leagues, it was a major thrill for you.
Well, and the way he, as you say, cracked in the major leagues was... I played for Sullivan High School, a mediocre player on a good team, and against Lane Tech. And Lane Tech had a star player named Jim Woods, who was a great hitter and great pitcher. And he was my size. I'm 6 feet. You know, I was about 180. And we played in. And I remember we had a game against them in early June of 1957. And then we graduated. He was my year. We were seniors. And immediately at graduation, the Cubs signed Jim Woods. Now, I had played with Jim Woods 3 weeks earlier. against Jim Woods, rather, and the Cubs signed him. Not only did they sign him, but they brought him up to the team immediately and put him on. And he was on the bench, and he was on the roster, and he was in the scoreboard, in the scorecard. You bought a scorecard, you see Jim Woods' number, whatever his number was, and here was a guy I'd just been playing with, and suddenly he's a major leaguer. And it turned out that he only got into two games at the end of the season, and both as a pinch runner. And then they traded him to the Phillies, and he had a short career with the Phillies, highlighted with he had three home runs, but highlighted by hitting a double off Sandy Koufax in the Dodgers in the Coliseum in Los Angeles, and they had a great big they had a short left field fence, but they had a 42-foot screen to make it seem like the left field was farther than it really was. And Jim Woods hit near the top of the screen. So he really, it would have been a home run. But he crushed Sandy Koufax hitting a double. And that was the highlight of his career. And somehow I identified with all this, you know, because here was a guy I played against. Actually, in basketball, too, we played against each other in Chicago Public League basketball. But it was a thrill for us. And then a bunch of us were in a car driving, and we were listening to the Cub game. And Jim Woods is now a pinch running for the Cubs. Oh my God! We're in the car. We're screaming and hollering. It was great.
You seem to have a fairly optimistic view of the future in terms of the game of baseball and young people. I mean, we hear a lot, think a lot about other sports sort of crowding in and grabbing more and more young athletes and more of their focus. But you don't particularly see that, and you see a very bright future for the game of baseball when we look at young people across the country.
Right. Well, you know, Little Leagues are still popular, and they're still young kids who are better at baseball, you know, talented kids who are better at baseball or like baseball more than they do basketball or football or even tennis. But that's America. That's one thing. But also the Latin countries, the Dominican Republic, even Venezuela. Puerto Rico, we get players from all these places, and they're all wonderful players. Look at all the Ramirez's and the Rodriguez's and the Gonzalez's, you know, who are playing in Major League Baseball and playing it so well, and it's exciting, and they're great, I think that baseball definitely has a future. And also, it's just an interesting game, and it's just a fun game to watch once you understand the game. You know, so many people say, it's boring, it's long, and everything. Well, not if you understand it, you know, and not if you care about it, and then get to know the players, you know, and have a sense of who they are and what their stories are. It's an enduring sport, and even though the owners sometimes are, seem to be intent on ruining the game with their lockouts or whatever, it endures, and it has endured, and I don't know, I still love it.
Mm. Sports writer Ira Burko, his book about Wrigley Field is titled Wrigley Field, an Oral and Narrative History of the Home of the Chicago Cubs. We should mention that this book was written and published before the Chicago Cubs finally, at long last, won another World Series. That's why that particular topic related to the Cubs did not come up in this interview, which dated back to 2014. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm looking forward to welcoming back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clawson Center, who will be joining us to talk about current events. He will offer, among other things, his analysis of the first 100 days of the presidency of President Donald Trump. That is tomorrow. Friday's morning show will include a preview of the performances this weekend of Gioachino Rossini's delightful comic opera, The Barber of Seville. I had the great pleasure of recording interviews with two members of the cast of the Milwaukee Florentines production, and you'll hear those conversations on Friday. Monday, you'll be hearing the heartwarming story of a 90-year-old woman who, having just received a cancer diagnosis, took to the road with her son and daughter-in-law for an amazing trek across the country. And next Tuesday, the president of Gateway Technical College, Brian Albrecht. A reminder that Wisconsin Public Radio's spring membership drive is underway right now. And every vote of support for WPR is also support for WGTD. Online